you know, it's reported that 30,000 to 50,000 people died in Libya, and at the moment that hundreds of thousands are being tortured, black Libyans are being lynched and tortured. Where is the democracy in Libya? Where is the democracy in Afghanistan? And we need to take these things into account when we're propagating a message to intervene into Syria. I think it's dangerous, and I think it's too much of a precarious situation to advocate full US NATO-led intervention.
I completely agree. I think, like you said, the history of NATO is not one that is very positive for coming in and saving and protecting civilians. Like you said, the death rate in Libya grew from 2,000, I believe, when NATO started airstrikes, and jumped to about 50,000 now is the estimate. And NATO refuses to do any sort of investigations about what happened during its bombing, and yet people are quickly saying, okay, well, whatever happened in Libya, we want to just take, you know, copy and paste and do it in Syria, when Syria, the situation is completely different.
Exactly.
In Syria, there is, you know, a much more heterogeneous population. There's the Free Syrian Army has not succeeded in liberating a section of the country, just like the fighters in Libya did with Benghazi. And then in Syria, we know, you know, again, I'm going to stress that this completely started off as a very authentic, legitimate local protest against, you know, regime abuses towards the population. But as happens in many places, there are definitely outside forces looking to take advantage of this. And we cannot ignore Syria's relationship with Iran and how certain countries, including the Gulf states and the United States, who seem very happy to arm the Syrians and seem more and more moving into some sort of intervention, perhaps, their bigger goal is Iran. And if Syria is going to turn into a proxy war between the U.S., the Gulf, Israel, and Iran, that just bodes disaster for the Syrian people themselves, who in the end of the day deserve freedom and dignity from their brutal regime. But, you know, this cannot be taken over by outside interests that just see the Syria as a place to fight off their wars between each other.
I agree.
Hang on one second, Amar, come in. Yeah, we have not heard from you for a while.
Okay.
Go on.
I would actually agree very much with what both your recent callers said. The Muslim Brotherhood conflict in the late 70s and 80s only ended when King Hussein of Jordan, the late King Hussein of Jordan, came out in the late 1985 in a televised public apology to Syria, which I actually saw live on the screen. Gulf states arming the opposition is actually repeating the same thing. Now, whether this would end with a public apology from their side, I actually doubt it. But it is indeed a regional issue that is stirring the pot. With regards to NATO as well, the Libya example is spot on. Before the NATO came in, we were counting hundreds of dead in Libya, and now we're counting tens of thousands of dead, and we're not so sure if Libya exists really anymore. Now, I think your Youssef, before we went to the news, Youssef from
Munich. Yeah.
I think he touched on a very crucial point as well with regards to the SNC's inability to control the field. And I think that's one of the most important reasons why the Annan plan isn't really working, because the armed groups do not follow a clear command and control structure. And apart from the fact, obviously, that the some regional powers have publicly pledged to arm them, but they also are incontrollable. And this notion of Free Syrian Army is actually more of a myth and an umbrella than a reality on the ground. Again, the videos that came out from Baba Amr after the Syrian Army re-seized control over it show that actually none of those people who were in that area and carrying weapons were an ex-military who defected from the Syrian Army.
Amar, you mentioned Jordan. I'm just going to jump in there just to bring in Badia, who's in Jordan. It'd be interesting to get her point of view on what's happening. Hello, Badia. Welcome to the program.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
And what are you thinking about the killings at the weekend that so many people have been writing about and thinking about online?
Yeah. Once we saw the pictures, we were frustrated. We were appalled. These are kids. These are children. Mass crimes are being... slaughtered, kids are being killed, knives are being held in their hearts. Who are these devils? I'm not coming here to speak from a political viewpoint, because I don't think I can give you a clear thought on that. But I'm coming here from a human perspective.
I mean, I'm just interested, actually, because we were just talking about the potential implications on neighbouring countries. Do you worry about the potential for this to spill over and affect your own country, Jordan?
Yes, of course. We welcome Syrians. If God forbid anything happens in Jordan, we want a country like Syria to hold us temporarily until things are resolved. But Jordan cannot economically, our health systems, our school systems cannot hold so many refugees.
So lots of people are crossing over from Syria as refugees, you say, into Jordan. Badia, I'm going to leave you there just because the telephone line to you there in Jordan is not the greatest. But thank you very much indeed for being with us on the programme. You heard, I hope, the flavour of what Badia was saying. Sonny, let's come back to you because we heard some pretty bleak assessments from our guests about what might happen if intervention is the thing that happens militarily. Well, just come back on that and give us your take.
Well, I just wanted to say, first of all, I'm not advocating intervention by NATO, especially given what has happened in Libya before.
You mentioned the Gulf states, I think, didn't you, when you were talking?
And the Gulf states. Yeah. Well, what I'm saying is, I think we're already too far down that track. I think that intervention is already taking place, that the level of intervention will only increase, and I share concerns about a fear of a regional war, because the fact is that you've had four major outside interventions in the Arab Spring. You had Libya, you've had Afghanistan, you've had Iraq, you've had Bahrain by the Saudis. And, you know, I live in the United States, and only a couple of months ago, we've had this warmongering by the Israeli lobby and by Bibi Netanyahu, where they're talking about launching a quote-unquote a preemptive attack on Iran's nuclear facilities. Now, if NATO and if the outside powers go into Syria with that blessing, then what is to stop the Israelis from also invoking a similar argument to go and attack Iran? And one of the things I've been talking with some of my folks down in the State Department and in the Department of Defense, and they've been war gaming this. And they say that, for example, if the Israelis launch an attack on the Iranian nuclear facilities, nuclear program, that you will have what everyone fears. You will have a regional war, because the Iranians have the capability, they have the resources, they have the missiles, where they could not only attack Israel, but they could attack any other country which they see is assisting in that. And that would include United States facilities, military facilities, and forces which are throughout the region.
Okay.
So the possibility of this spiraling out of control of everyone, including the United States, the Saudis, the Iranians,
okay,
and everyone else.
Yeah, Mohadish, I think you wanted to come in there. Yeah.
I think what we need to relate back to is the issue of the right of self-determination. And the right of self-determination has a central place in the Charter of the United Nations and in the two 1966 International Covenants on Human Rights. And I'd bring in a quote from John Pilger where he says, "Today, another Afghanistan and Iraq beckon in Syria and Iran, perhaps even a world war." I think, personally, I'm implacably opposed to external intervention, especially military intervention. I believe it will increase Arab and Muslim alienation from the Western powers. And I think that public opinion would not support further military intervention, especially at a time when growing austerity policies pose a threat to living standards within people in Britain. I think what the speaker before me just said about...
You can talk directly to him. Talk to Sunny, yeah.
Yeah, Sunny, when you said that intervention has already started taking place, I think if the level of intervention is nowhere near what could possibly happen, and what could it might emulate what happened in Libya. I think what we need to really focus on is the right of self-determination of people, and I think that the Syrian people the conflict should be resolved by the Syrian people themselves. I believe that sanctions have never been an alternative to war. I think they're more of a prelude to it. And I think that intervention is almost stealing the right of the Syrian people to dictate their own fate and to dictate their own system of government, which is, I think, completely in their hands.
So if intervention is not the answer, and I'll open this up to some of you others, Rama and Ammar, if intervention is not the answer to stopping the violence that's going on, what is? And it connects actually to a comment that lots of people are retweeting. It's from an article in The New Yorker today by John Lee Anderson, who asked, what does one do when men become capable of cutting the throat of a small child, and this sense of powerlessness that's perhaps out there? Ammar, what could the solution be to solving some of this violence?
Well, I'll come to that shortly, but commenting on this retweeted thingy, basically I think Al-Hula thing could actually backfire. Let us suppose that this thing is proven not to be the direct, has happened without the direct involvement of the Syrian army. So basically the Syrian army was not to blame on the Hula massacre. Now, what would the countries who actually support the armed groups would we be looking like? You know, would they stop supporting those armed groups? I think that is a very, very big question. Now, with regards to the intervention, I think, again, I agree with your Afghani scholar in London. I'm 100% agreeing with her. What is happening now in Syria is very similar to what happened to her country in the early 80s. There was a perceived Russian-backed government, progressive government at the time, and you had the Charlie Wilsons of the world initiating Operation Cyclone to bring jihadis and Islamic fanatics into Afghanistan, arming them with anti-rocket, anti-tank missiles, Stinger missiles, and so on and so forth. And 30 years later, the same thing is happening. Now, how to deal with the situation in Syria? First of all, we need to understand that not all the Syrians want President Assad to go. I think this is the key issue that everybody needs to understand. Okay. He still enjoys a large base of support. And if the international community is really interested in bringing Syria from state A to state B, they can go to the Syrian government and say, look, guys, we know you're not very democratic. We know you have a bit of corruption, and we can fix that, or we can help you fix that. What do you want? Expertise, project management, money. How can we help? Instead of raising the finger and threatening and allowing fanatics and Muslim fanatics and bringing Syria into this regional conflict that it has got nothing to do with between Iran and Saudi Arabia.
I think this back to how this entire uprising started. We have to remember back last March when kids in Daraa got up and started writing on the wall the need for freedom. They were captured and tortured. And I think sometimes we have to always go back to that beginning of that this started off very much authentic, legitimate, the need against the regime. The problem with foreign military